Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program Number 577, Truth and Consequences, interview with Ed Haslam and Daniel Hopsicker. This has been recorded on November 19th of the year 2006. And once again, it is my pleasure and privilege to bring back to our airwaves Ed Haslam, the author of Mary's Monkey, and also Daniel Hopsicker, the author of, among other titles, Barry and the Boys, that we'll be talking about tonight. Welcome to Terrorland and numerous articles on the Mad Cow News website. Gentlemen, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
All righty. Now, we have been talking about evidentiary and historical tributaries that have flown forward from November 22nd, 1963, both Ed's story of Mary's Monkey and Daniel's story of Barry Seal and his involvement with David Ferry go back to the milieu of the Kennedy assassination in New Orleans, specifically both Barry Seal and Dr. Mary Sherman, the Mary in the Mary's Monkey title, had associations through various milieu, plural, with David Ferry. David Ferry was an intelligence operative, an organized crime operative, a man with more connections than a switchboard, and somebody whom the House Select Committee on Assassination said the Justice Department should investigate in researching the conspiracy behind President Kennedy's assassination. And both of your investigations of the people in and around David Ferry have moved forward through time and have revealed that a great deal has evolved from the events in and around New Orleans on November 22nd, 1963, and that period. Ed, in Side 1, you mentioned that there was a witness, a new witness, that whose information bears heavily on your investigation in Mary's Monkey. Tell us about that.
Well, in the first version of the book, Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus, I speculated how, if you were going to develop a biological weapon, what resources would you need? And you'd need a place, and you need to have the monkey virus, and you need to have people to handle the actual experiments. You need to have somebody who's a lab technician in there. And I had always hoped that once I got my story out that we might hear from somebody who participated in this to give us some confirmation. And we now have a person who has come forward who said, yes, that was me, that is what I did. And her name is Judith Very Baker. Now, the first thing I want to point out about her, because there's a lot of controversy about her on the internet because a lot of people have tried to discredit her, and that her information has not been properly presented. The first thing I want to say is this woman worked at the Riley Coffee Company with Lee Harvey Oswald, and she has the W-2 form submitted by the Riley Coffee Company to the U.S. Internal Revenue Service to prove that she did. Okay? And I have posted that document on a website for her, okay? And the website is Judith Very Baker. Judith is normal spelling. Very is V-A-R-Y, and Baker is like baker of bread.
And very quickly, let me jump in and fill in for younger listeners who might not be familiar with the significance of that. The Riley Coffee Company was one of the companies in New Orleans that employed Lee Harvey Oswald. Now, Oswald, at the point of the employment with Riley Coffee, had allegedly defected to the Soviet Union with top secret information about the U-2 and our North American radar defense nets, and yet was able to repatriate back to the United States with no problem, become the sole member of the New Orleans chapter of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, an ostensible pro-Castro organization, and yet was able to get employment with, among other companies, the Riley Coffee Company, whose founder, Mr. Riley, was an active right-wing politico who was a financier of anti-Castro Cuban activities in and around New Orleans, which is one of the things that makes Oswald's employment by Mr. Riley under the circumstances so strange. Go ahead.
First of all, we have a document that proves that Judith Very Baker worked at Riley at the same time that Lee Harvey Oswald did, okay? So you get in the second layer of this is, did she know him? Well, when you notice that they both started on the same day, and the day that she got fired, which was about 2 weeks after he got fired, was the day that he was passing out leaflets in front of the International Trade Mart, a couple blocks away from Riley, and there's a connection between those events because she was with him passing out leaflets. Okay, the dates are very clear in the pay stubs. Everything's very clear on this. Now you say, well, who is this woman and why was she in New Orleans and all this stuff? And you go back to a very lengthy trail of newspaper articles which were published about her in her hometown in Florida, and we discover this person was trained by the leading monkey virus researchers in America, and we have the documents to prove it. If this woman didn't say anything else, and I knew these two things about her, that she worked with Lee Harvey Oswald and she was trained to handle cancer-causing monkey viruses, she would be a suspect in my book about this biological weapon. Turns out that she says, yes, we were developing a biological weapon. And that job at the coffee company was set up for Lee and I. And we reported to an ex-FBI agent who later testified to the Warren Commission and didn't bother to mention me to the Warren Commission. Okay? There's a lot of stuff here, but this woman says that she stood in David Ferry's apartment several times a week with Lee Harvey Oswald at her elbow, with David Ferry present, and performed experiments on cancer tumors involving cancer-causing monkey viruses, and did so explicitly for the purpose of developing a biological weapon to kill Fidel Castro. And this, I think, is pretty serious news. And I have a very simple website that people can go to if you want to see more information on this. I wrote a whole chapter on this woman and presented all the newspaper articles and the documents. The name of the website is The Monkey Virus, themonkeyvirus.com. And you just go there and click on the new chapter, and you'll get a 20-page PDF that explains all this stuff in glorious detail.
All righty. Very quickly, Ed, because I want to swing back to Daniel's story of what came out of New Orleans as well in a minute. I'm going to ask the impossible. I'm going to ask you to explain very quickly about the polyoma, about Doctors Stewart, Eddy, and Sherman, and how a monkey virus being researched by the cast of characters that you focused on, could cause cancer. Bear in mind that that is really new to most people. Go ahead.
Well, there was a huge epidemic or an epidemic of polio in the 1950s. There was a huge effort to distribute a polio vaccine to stop the epidemic. That vaccine was grown on monkey kidneys. And after they had released 100 million doses of the vaccine, they realized that there were several viruses in that vaccine that were causing problems. One of them was notoriously good at causing cancer, and they named it SV40. Standing for simian virus number 40, but it is a cancer-causing monkey virus. It was in the polio vaccine. It was discovered by the researchers at the National Institutes of Health. The government knew about it in the late 1950s. Mary Sherman, who was closely connected to those people, knew about it. And this witness, Judith Baker, explicitly says that Mary Sherman was involved in this project to develop the biological weapon.
And in a number of programs we've talked about, including the aforementioned For the Record 19, about how SV40 causes cancer. It has a protein, large T antigen, which not only explodes basically the DNA of cells, thereby making it potentially carcinogenic, but it also neutralizes the RB proteins and the P53 gene, both of which help to kill abnormally reproducing cells, thereby preventing cancer. But the SV40 neutralizes that, and so after disrupting the nucleic material, the nucleic acid in cells, the DNA and the RNA, it then permits those cells to go ahead and reproduce, whereas the body would normally, and the immune system would normally kill them. And as you pointed out in your book, and as can be heard in the aforementioned FTR-19, that contamination of the polio vaccine has led to an epidemic of soft tissue cancers in people who are alive or were alive up to the present time. In your book, Daniel, in Barry and the Boys, you once again trace what came out of New Orleans through the years. Tell us a little bit about what Barry Seal did after he was in the Civil Air Patrol unit with Oswald, run by David Ferry, and after he helped to pilot, he piloted a getaway plane to spirit some of the assassins out of Dallas on 11/22/63.
Oh, he went to Laos, where he flew for Air America. And then he flew for Howard Hughes's airline, TWA, which I believe gave him cover to do all sorts of things in Europe, which I have no real knowledge of. And then I know he worked for the DEA, of all things, and established, along with another Kennedy assassination figure of interest, a flight school out in between Tucson and Phoenix, Arizona, in a tiny town called Eloy, which the DEA established in 1976 to teach pilots to fly twin-engine planes so that they could come all the way back from South America with dope without having to make a couple puddle jumps. This I found so incredible. Gerald Patrick Hemming told me that. I found this so incredible that when I was out there doing research on something else one time with Brian Queeg was driving me around, God rest his soul, and I think God rest his soul. A lot of people had problems with him. We stopped in Eloy, and I found out that sure enough, there had been a DEA-sponsored flight school there, and training people on twin-engine planes. You know, remember in '76 that was a big deal, and that very soon thereafter, military cargo planes began coming in with loads of dope. Strange world.
Now, during the Iran-Contra affair, there was the first, in my political consciousness, first widespread awareness of the involvement of elements of the intelligence community in the illegal narcotics traffic, and Barry Seal was deeply involved in that. I wonder if you'd tell us a little bit about Barry and the Iran-Contra affair, Daniel.
Well, he was assassinated in order to keep him from talking about it. He was about to. He had cut a deal with the then Vice President of the United States, George Herbert Walker Bush, that he would not have to go to prison and suffer any serious consequences. Then the IRS, unaware of perhaps of that deal, confiscated all his household furniture. And so in the presence of his attorney, who told me the story, Barry Seal went in the back room of his house that was being rid of all its furniture by the IRS at that moment, and called the Vice President of the United States, who he threatened over the phone. And 10 days later, he was dead.
Indeed, and he died with George Bush's private phone number in his pocket. Now, bear in mind, that's the elder George Bush, by the way. This is the largest drug smuggler in American history, or at least the largest one whose information has come to light.
Allegedly. If you've been sued four times like I have now, you tend to slip allegedly. You know, like most people say, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, who allegedly had the elder George Bush's...
Seal's attorney did tell me one time that he sat Barry Seal down. He was facing serious drug charges. And he said, Barry, I have to know, if I'm going to defend you, I have to know what happened. I have to know what's going on. Because his client hadn't told him anything really about it. And so Barry kind of smiled and said, well, you want to know what's going on? Okay, pick up the phone. And so... the attorney picked up the phone, and then Seal gave him a number that rang through to the White House. And Seal said, now ask for, tell him you're Barry Seal. And he says, the operator, hi, I'm Barry Seal. And the operator says, just a minute, sir, and switched him. And the next voice on the phone was that of Admiral Daniel Murphy, who was George Bush's national security advisor. And his all-around factotum at the time. And at this point, the attorney was flummoxed and said, oh, Admiral, I'm sorry, I'm not really Barry Seal. I'm just, you know, started explaining what was going on, and click, the phone went dead. Little anecdotes like that tend to explain what was going on. Mm-hmm. And what is still going on, because if Prohibition had never ended, Al Capone would rule the world. That's exactly the situation we face in America today. As long as the drug war, in quotes, is continuing, I think we'll have a difficult time finding a president who wasn't first a Southern governor.
Well, Daniel, in Welcome to Terrorland, the second of the two books that you've published, you highlight Mohammed Atta and some of the other 9/11 hijackers' activities in southern Florida. And one of the things that permitted the hijackers, those who were to become the 9/11 hijackers, or at least some of them, to operate with impunity in the United States is the fact that they were working in the context of some of these protected, government-connected drug smuggling networks. And in fact, as you began to sleuth around down there in the Venice area, you began to discover that some of the air flotillas, let's make the word recognizable, the air flotillas that were connected to people like Wally Hilliard, Rudy Deckers, the people who brought Marwan al-Shahi and Mohammed Atta into the country, or through whose operations they infiltrated. And you began finding that these were some of the same people who'd worked with Barry Seal, that even some of the same aircraft were involved in the larger circle of associations of Mohammed Atta, Deckers, Wally Hilliard and company, as had been involved with Barry Seal. I wonder if you tell us a little bit about, I mean, listeners to this probably have heard about those networks, but develop that a little further for us, if you would.
Well, probably the straightest connection is the following one. As you're well aware now, but 99.9% of Americans aren't, during the same month that Atta arrived to attend his flight school, the owner of the flight school has Learjet confiscated on the runway of Orlando Executive Airport by DEA agents with submachine guns who found 43 pounds of heroin on board. Now, 43 pounds of heroin is the Orlando Sentinel called it the biggest drug bust in Central Florida history. You know, now you can imagine how big that had to be the biggest drug bust in Florida, Central Florida history. You know, it's not like we're talking about Minnesota here. And yet the Sarasota Herald Tribune to this day has not seen fit to print that fact. Apparently it's not newsworthy that Mohammed Atta's flight school owner, the same month Atta arrived, had his Learjet busted for 43 pounds of heroin. That may be something of a taboo subject, but here's the interesting Seal connection. The Learjet that got busted with the 43 pounds of heroin, Hilliard had gotten from a guy who had just died named Gary Levitz. And Gary Levitz was flying in had been busted with the Whittington brothers. Gary Levitz was the son of the guy that founded Levitz Furniture, and he was a Confederate pilot, Air America type guy, and an all-around drug smuggler, arrested several times for drug smuggling, the most serious of which was with the Whittington brothers. Now, Barry Seal had gotten his, who was still very active, at least in jets. And every time I go over to Fort Lauderdale Airport, I steer clear of WorldJet because that's what they own. And I understand they're not too pleased with me for mentioning it, but I mean, it's public record. The Whittington brothers got busted. And when they got busted in 1980, their Learjet went to Barry Seal. Now, when Gary Levitz died eight or nine years ago, and he apparently had been involved in something, his Learjet went to Wally Hilliard, and that's the jet. So the same sources, and you'd have to say that these are CIA connected individuals, because I don't think anyone operates in Southwest or Southern Florida in an aviation context. You can't do much underhanded that isn't going to be immediately caught. They're looking for it.
Yeah, I would alter that ever so slightly, Daniel, to say intelligence connected, because, you know, whether it's CIA or whether it's one of these privatized companies that works for elements of the Pentagon as well, or perhaps a foreign intelligence outfit, it's intelligence. It's connected with authorities. Our government and our intelligence system obviously is involved with these elements to a considerable extent.
Sure.
But this is what you have focused on.
We're still waiting for someone to get busted for owning a plane found with 5.5 tons of cocaine 4 or 5 months ago down in Mexico. Well, I guess the DEA in Tampa has just overlooked that case.
But what you've been investigating, not only in Barry and the Boys, but also in examining the air networks through which Mohammed Atta and company came into the United States and which permitted them to do what they did, you're looking at an area where the overworld, the world of big names, big corporations, big politics, big money, big commerce meets the underworld, the supposedly marginalized, shady characters who do horrible things like bringing in drugs and murdering people.
And that's why I think it's so big that Wolfgang Borringer, on the Wolfgang Borringer story, that the FBI put out a terror alert for an associate of Mohammed Atta, Wolfgang Borringer, who had been the private pilot while he knew Atta, who Atta called my brother. He was the private pilot for a guy I'd never heard of named Victor Kozeny, who's an obviously Russian mob-connected individual who moved to Czechoslovakia in 1993 after the Berlin Wall went down, and within 3 years controlled one-third of the economy of the entire nation of Czechoslovakia.
And an individual with, as I like to say, more connections than a switchboard. When the young barefoot Kozeny was just 18 years old, reminds me a little bit of Barry Seal, who was just a wee tad when he was hooking up with David Ferry. Victor Kozeny, by the way, Ed, when Daniel was relating Victor Kozeny's early activities in the United States, he just showed up on the doorstep of a professor. Turns out that professor was deeply involved with research into the Star Wars program, and another of Kozeny's associates was the Chief Air Force Weapons Procurement Officer. And this guy's like 18 years old or something, and just sort of like an Eastern European Huckleberry Finn who came over here with his fishing pole slung over his shoulder and showed up with a straw in his mouth and said, "Why, shucks, here I am. Can you teach me to fish?" And it turns out that there are some very, very big fish indeed swimming in the waters inhabited by Mr. Kozeny.
Well, let me just make a footnote comment since we were talking about the JFK assassination.
Yep.
There was a guy named Bobby Baker who was very involved in the LBJ investigations before Kennedy got killed. And as we sit here in 2006, we've heard a lot about congressional pages recently due to the Mark Foley scandal, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that there's been much conversation that Bobby Baker went to Washington, D.C. as a congressional page with $60 in his pocket, and by the time he was finished, had millions and millions of dollars and was involved in fronting for Sam Giancana out of Chicago on the vending machines. And what you've got there is you've got a congressional page serving as a conduit for organized crime communicating between elected legislatures.
And so he went with $60 in his pocket and was a millionaire just a few years later.
Yeah.
Is this a great country or what?
Well,
I mean, I guess that's my idea. That's gallows humor, I guess, under the circumstances. We're down to our last 5 minutes of the broadcast. Ed, let's follow. Oh, no, Daniel, had you finished with your discussion of Borringer, or was there something else you wanted to add?
I was gonna slip this in, and now since it's the last 5 minutes of your show and nobody's listening to us anyway, I can put it out. Wolfgang, they caught Wolfgang.
Oh, good.
Yeah. What I hear is that the terrorism task force guy that told the source that they had caught him said that, and with the first words out of Wolfgang's mouth, he went from a 5 to an 8.
So Borringer is now in custody, and apparently his value is increasing in the eyes of the investigators.
We think that what that might mean is that Borringer said, "You can't bust me, I'm with the CIA." But, of course, that's pure speculation.
Or somebody, somebody who can't be touched. Ed, following forward, the events that you start chronicling back in 1963, the significance of Mary's Monkey, the significance of the SV-40 for people today.
First of all, let me say the title of the new book is Dr. Mary's Monkey.
Oh, okay. Dr. Mary's Monkey. Go ahead.
There has been a epidemic of cancer, certainly in the United States, if not beyond. About 1 out of 10 people will get cancer before this is all over. This is, we're talking about millions of cases of cancer. We're talking about billions of dollars of medical insurance premiums. All this stuff relates to this one virus, which has been described by professional DNA people as the most carcinogenic entity they've ever discovered. And this is sexually transmitted. It is now in the human blood supply. And I think it's a reasonable conclusion, and certainly my conclusion, that there's a very real connection between the SV40 in the human blood supply and the epidemic of cancer that has occurred, even if the press has not spoken about it.
Indeed. And I think it was February of 2000, the Atlantic Monthly had an article about the SV40 epidemic. And again, your work no longer stands alone either, Ed. The book, The Virus and the Vaccine by Debbie Bookshin and Jim Schumacher, chronicles the SV40 epidemic and its implications for the average American. So Daniel, Wolfgang has been busted.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, well, we'll see what takes place.
But the connection there, I mean, and this is huge, is Wolfgang Borger, who Muhammad Atta called, Wolfgang Borger was as close to Muhammad Atta as anyone alive,
mm-hmm.
okay?
Mm-hmm.
And the connection went all the way back to Germany and predated Florida. And Wolfgang Borger is tied into the Russian mob. So we've got a whole different spin here now.
And Wolfgang Borger also is tied into, among other things, the Flying Club of Munich and some of the tributaries that flow into and out of that that we've chronicled in your work. One of the things you've noted, Daniel, is that some of the networks you began investigating all the way back in New Orleans in 1963 have evolved through the present, and that those networks overlap the crimes of September 11, 2001, and the networks that were involved in that and that have been gone largely untouched. And Ed, you too began investigating events around 1963 in New Orleans with David Ferry, for whom Barry Seal worked in the Civil Air Patrol. And once again, following those tributaries forward, we come to a cancer epidemic. We come to people today getting sick and dying because of events connected to
Let me go back on the political side of this for a second.
We're almost out of time, by the way. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, the guy that was in charge of the House Committee on Un-American Activities, that was Congressman Willis in 1963,
mm-hmm.
whose office was across the street from the Riley Coffee Company. Now, this woman who works with Lee Oswald and is over at David Ferry's apartment in the afternoon, she's running messages in and out of Willis's office throughout the day.
All righty. Well, that there is another piece of information. The point that I want to make, particularly for younger listeners, too, a lot of people wonder, you know, the Kennedy assassination was a long time ago, 43 years this Wednesday. Who cares? The point being, when you don't care about the truth, it has consequences. You may not care about the Kennedy assassination, but you wind up with a cancer-causing monkey virus in your veins as a result of the endemic lying that comes out of events like 11-22-63, or you wind up with what is figuratively known on the street as a monkey on your back. You wind up hooked on drugs, in part as a result of the evolution of the forces that were already at work in New Orleans, among other places, on November 22, 1963, and that moved forward, or you might be at work in your job at the Pentagon or the late Great World Trade Center, and things don't go as you thought they were going to go during your workday, and you wind up seriously discomforted as a result. Very quickly, gentlemen, your websites, really, really quickly, where people can get your books, real fast.
MadCowProd.com.
Okay, MadCowProd.com, and Ed?
TheMonkeyVirus.com.
And that's where you can get the new editions of Dr. Mary's Monkey and Barry and the Boys. And also www.spitfirelist.com, and linked websites where you can follow up on some of the earlier broadcasts with both Ed Haslam and Daniel Hopsicker about the events they've been investigating. Gentlemen, thank you so much for your participation. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 577, Truth and Consequences interview with Ed Haslam and Daniel Hopsicker. This has been recorded on November 19th of 2006. My name's Dave Emery. For Ed Haslam and Daniel Hopsicker, thanks for listening.